Hello, my name is Stephen Buckley. I'm here with Colin Mills, a friend of mine. And tonight, he's mostly going to talk about a bunch of issues which have become disturbingly political in the last decade or so. Faith and belief is the title of a number of topics he's going to talk about tonight. And first, before we get into it, I'd like to just give you a chance to tell us, everyone in the world, a little bit about yourself in terms of your family, church, religious history, like where you come from and where you're at now.
Well, my background is that I was born into a family where my father was a minister and was expected to go to church and quite embraced church for quite a long time. I embraced essentially North American style evangelical Christianity. And over the last number of years, prior to me leaving the church, I started asking a lot of questions as to what was going on in the church, what was the nature of my faith and my beliefs. And as a result, eventually I left the church. I may actually return, but on entirely different terms at some point. And when I left the church, I wrote letters to some people in order, probably really just in order to understand myself what was going on, but also to communicate to some other people what I felt were some of the endemic problems within the church. These things that I'm going to be talking tonight are either summaries of, or in one case, a direct reading of some of the things I wrote.
So before we jump into the big meaty topics, I want to give you a chance to talk about postmodernism and everything that came before this current postmodernist phase we're in.
Well, I came to study this material as part of my master's thesis, which I did on the geography of New Age spirituality in Vancouver. And I did that at the time as an evangelical Christian. Even though I maintained academic standards while doing it, I was sort of seeing it as an opportunity to understand this world that existed, that seemed so alien to me. And so I ended up reading a lot about postmodernism. Reading about postmodernism took me back to modernism, and modernism took me back to pre-modernism. And what I've discovered is that my own faith, the way faith is expressed in the world right now, is quite tied into these larger cultural shifts, these paradigms. And there's a big benefit in understanding how it is we came to be where we are as a culture, and how the church fits into that, and how the church is sort of manifesting some of the problems of that. So in the pre-modern world, and by the pre-modern world, we're basically talking pre-Enlightenment, pre-industrial revolution. And in that world, people were very intimately connected to their environment and the physical environment. They were very connected to the way the world operated naturally. But beyond that, they were also very spiritual. And that spirituality was assumed. Sociologist Peter Berger writes about the sacred canopy. And the sacred canopy was essentially the filter through which virtually everyone in pre-Enlightenment European society, it was the way that they interpreted the world. Everything was seen through the glasses of spirituality. People were aware that there was this force that was causing things to happen. If a flood came, you would look at what did you do wrong to encourage this flood to be brought upon you, or if your crops failed. And virtually every society through history has interpreted things this way, at least in a sort of a pre-Enlightenment existence.
Is this kind of like a time where I like to idealize and get all nostalgic about, you know, the pre-linear progress days when we were all sort of symbiotically in touch with nature, and we dealt on a cycle of seasons, and everything was cyclical, as opposed to this constant economic growth thing that came with the
Sure, absolutely. And what's interesting is, as we've moved into postmodernism, I'll jump ahead a little bit and then take it back. As we moved into postmodernism, people have been looking back to exactly this world. In fact, they've been looking really to three areas from North American culture. One is things that are removed from Western culture in time. So anything pre-modern is seen as being genuine. People have looked away from anything, or looked rather to anything that is removed from North American culture in space. So we're looking to Eastern religions and South American religions.
We go to India.
We go to India. We follow the Beatles. We go to the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and seek enlightenment from him. And then everyone tromps off to Tibet to get enlightenment because it's not North America. It's not because it's Tibet. It's because it's
Brad
not
Pitt
North
it.
America. Well, the Beatles did it long before Brad Pitt did it. And some of the poets did it even before that.
Mm-hmm.
The other place they look is to essentially whatever is outside of modern culture, which is nature. So nature, the past, and the distant are the three sort of locuses for loci for meaning in the postmodern world.
Amina was talking about that too in another podcast, especially about this reverence for going native in North America. It's
absolutely
like the idealizes people who are, you know,
yeah,
potlatches and medicine wheels and that kind of stuff.
And it turns out there's problems with this because we co-opt things. And postmodernism has a lot of problems in that it steals from the past and it just cherry picks from traditions and religions and histories without providing any real context. You take the Buddhism, but you remove the 40-day fasts or whatever it is they ask for you, because you remove the uncomfortable things. Critics of postmodern style religion refer to it as supermarket religion, New Age of supermarket religion, where you pull from the shelves of the religious supermarket the supernatural products of your choice. The reality is that postmodernism is neither fully good nor bad. It's not an answer. It's just another way of us doing things, and it's going to come with its inherent problems. But in the pre-modern world, everything was seen in a pretty unified way. People were aware of God, and people pretty much believed the same stuff. And if they didn't believe the same things, no one really worried about it because God was in control. And then the Enlightenment came along and people started thinking rationally. They started thinking about cause and effect. They started thinking about science and understanding the world. And over time, this led to people trying to see how they could not only understand the world, but, well, if they understood it, they could also influence it. So this leads to people developing medical science, developing all the other branches of science. And it was a pretty impressive project. People started coming up with real answers. People started fixing diseases. They came up with penicillin. They came up with pasteurization. They saved lives. They could do operations. They figured out germs. They did all kinds of extremely impressive things that made our quality of life better. But the inevitable result of that, we started asking the question, well, gee, if we can understand all these things, and we just seem to be understanding more and more over time, really, is there anything we can't know? And if there's really nothing in the end that we can't know, ultimately, then why do we need God?
Mm. And then came Nietzsche.
And it's interesting because Nietzsche is remembered for the statement, God is dead. But the second part of that statement is totally forgotten, which is, and we have killed him.
Yeah. Yeah, the poor guy, the most abused philosopher.
Oh, my
history.
God.
Everybody
he's the whipping
Nietzsche.
Boy.
Yeah.
But he was
totally
right.
Deserved. Yeah.
God died, and we killed him because our science answered the questions.
Yeah. Or thought we answered the questions.
Exactly.
Until
the,
Einstein.
It was impressive, anyway.
Yeah.
So, someone once said, I can't remember who it was, but said, we don't have all the answers yet. We just don't have all the science.
Mm.
It's not that we don't have the answers, it's just that we don't have all the science.
Does this also, this reminds me of the Bill Moyers, Joseph Campbell stuff about Star Wars and this sort of belief that technology will save us, and Lucas's sort of injection of this idea that the blind faith in technology and the classic thing for now is spent nuclear fuel rods. We'll bury them, and technology in the future, while the half-life is counting down, will tell us, somehow we'll find out how to deal with this nuclear mess that we've made, and that we can't it's silly, and the wrong trousers, even Wallace and Gromit is all about, you know, blind faith in technology going to save us is actually, you know, it's a leap of maybe quite silly.
Well,
faith.
I mean, as I read Star Wars, I never really thought about it. Ultimately, he says technology will take us far enough, but in the end, Luke uses the Force. He uses spirituality.
Yeah.
And he technology could only take him so far. Right. And ultimately, he went with something beyond. So.
And that was Lucas's thesis that Bill Moyers and Joseph Campbell were all about in the 80s. Yeah.
So the problem started showing up in the sort of post-World War I, post-World War II era, and our science started coming and biting us back. We created thalidomide. We created the nuclear bomb. I mean, we now had the power to wipe ourselves out. Our science had had created as many problems as it had solved, it seemed. Chernobyl. Dickens writes about the problems of industrial society ad nauseum. And we started being a little bit skeptical. It took quite a long time, but eventually people started coming to the impression that maybe this wasn't so great. But in this modernist era, this post-Enlightenment era, it was pretty devastating on the church. The people just started abandoning the church because they didn't really need God anymore. And sociologists created the secularization thesis, and the secularization thesis said that over time, or predicted that over time, religion would decline and become less and less important, and eventually would probably entirely disappear. And this is kind of where I stepped in my research. I was looking at this neighborhood in Vancouver called Kitsilano that was sort of this New Age hub and had been since the 1960s in the era of the hippies. And in Kitsilano, a student who had gone before me had discovered that Kitsilano was highly, highly secularized by all standard measures of religiosity, church attendance, membership in churches, weekly attendance at church services, census responses to religious questions. It was one of the most secularized areas, in fact, in all of Canada. One person at one point reported that there were fewer people on a per capita basis attending church on Sunday mornings in Kitsilano than in the center of Moscow during the communist era. It was a highly secularized area. But I went into it, and I looked around, and all I saw was spirituality everywhere. And I'm asking, why is this area so spiritual, but at the same time comes up as being secular?
It's measurement tools.
Exactly. The problem was measurement tools. And what people weren't doing is they weren't realizing that there was a new spirituality, that the game had been redefined. People were not engaging with spirituality in the form that they had previously. They were no longer going to churches, but that didn't necessarily mean they weren't spiritual. So the question is, what has the church done through all this? So what is the role of postmodernism then in all of this? Well, after people realized that science was creating some problems, they started being a little bit pessimistic. They started being suspicious of science, of modernism, of the sort of Enlightenment project, because it was cold. It was it asked the question, how do things work, extremely well, but it was really, really bad at answering the question, what do things mean? And after a period of time, people were really feeling that this world was becoming sort of cold and meaningless. And you know, through everything from, you know, Charlie Chaplin writing about or making movies about sort of the industrial machine to Dickens, Metropolis was the movie, to Dickens, to all of the
Frank
rhetoric.
Capra. Meet John Frank Doe Capra. And Terry Gilliam's Brazil. And
all of
George
those things
Orwell.
Were about the world becoming just a meaningless machine, that we were becoming machines, and that our world was sort of escaping our grasp. And if you look at things like art and poetry and music from this high, high modernist era, it was completely separate from the music, for example, which I have a great interest in, was completely separate from the listener. that people were writing things for the experiment of it, but they weren't even paying attention to the fact that someone might be listening to their music, which is why this music is so fucking hard to listen to.
That's why I don't like contemporary Canadian classical music.
Most of it's crap until the postmodernist comes along, and now there's starting to be some really good classical music again.
Yeah.
So people kind of rejected these notions, and other people came along, like the Beatles, and they started saying, you know what, there's another way of doing this. And they started looking to the past. They started looking to areas that were distant from North American modernist culture. And they started looking to nature, all of which were uncontaminated by the modernist project. And they started finding meaning in the things that were sort of made unavailable to them during that modernist time. And really, the search was for meaning. Mm. How do we glean meaning from life? And
that's people, when John and Yoko end up in the
John
hotel
and Yoko
room
end up in hotel rooms, and the Maharishi takes off, and transcendental meditation takes off,
mm-hmm.
and Shirley MacLaine comes along,
mm-hmm.
and you know, they write Hair, and the hippies come along, and they do drugs, which create spiritual experiences, and people start rejecting what their parents had sort of forced down their throat. And the hippies were a big part of getting this mobilized. The fact that they were a demographically very significant chunk of the population really gave this momentum.
And then Vietnam War was...
And the Vietnam War, exactly.
Yeah.
Total kick in the head.
It was
sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. It tipped the scale. And so people started exploring different things, and part of that was a re-enchantment of the world, a re-exploration of spirituality, which from the church's perspective on first blush might have seemed like a good idea, but the reality was that these people kind of tied the church in with modernism. The church had become modernist, so they sort of said, you know what, you're part of the problem, you're not part of the answer, we're not going back to you. You scientificated the Bible. You have organized society and been part of governments organizing society in ways that are dehumanizing. And they started saying, you know what, we're going to personalize this. We're going to have our own spirituality. We're not going to let you dictate what spirituality is. And we start breaking into postmodernism and reality fragments.
And the worshipping of the subjective, and that
exactly
a corporate body of belief isn't necessarily going to appeal to me because my subjective reality.
Exactly,
can be
I'm a the best quote I had from doing my thesis was the guy who said, "I used to be an atheist until I realized I was God," and it really summarized everything. That in the new world, you had the potential to become God, and the reality was subjective. Reality was made up of however many billion people, each experiencing the world in their own ways. And we've learned tremendous amounts from that. Huge social movements have come from awareness that not everyone experiences the world in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from virtually every academic discipline has had to grapple with this
mm-hmm.
reality. And in some places it led to just outright relativism, which is really tremendously unsustainable. But it was inevitable that it would go there. The church, in response, is terrified because it just does not know how to deal with pluralism. It does not know how to deal with what's beyond this. And as a result, they've kind of just clamped down a little bit tighter. And I think the evangelical Christian movement in the United States is really just a response to a world that they feel is just spinning out of control. They don't get all these people experiencing the world in different ways and opening themselves up to other forms of experiencing God. They just... It doesn't fit in their paradigm. It doesn't
so they get
fit.
Really black and white about
they
it.
They get really black and white because it gives them a sense of security. The world is just too scary.
Somebody sent me an email recently about a report. I didn't read it closely, but it was something like studying 50 or 60 years of conservative political movements in various countries in the world and demonstrating the link between conservatism and totalitarianism, and that conservative movements, whether party strengthening or when society gets more conservative, there's a tendency and a lure to embrace totalitarian views.
Yeah.
And apparently this report documents in all these different places for the last half century.
I totally
or so.
Believe that.
And on an intuitive level, it just makes perfect sense.
It makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
It takes tremendous trust to create and maintain an open society. You have to trust that the people around you are going to, of their own accord, for the most part, act in a way that is supportive of the greater good. And the conservative Christians are just too suspicious of all these people who are worshiping other gods and worshiping their God in another way. And they just want to clamp down on everything and legislate morality.
Well, and postmodernism also sort of goes along with liberal Christianity, which of course scares the shit out of conservative Christianity.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And so they see that as a threat because the soft people have been seduced by the subjectivity of it all.
And this ties into something that we'll discuss in another podcast on the concept of values packaging, which is something that's quite, I'm quite passionate about.